Dan Marcus's Wax Museum is a podcast and a website featuring conversations I've had past and present with artists from rock and roll's formative years. If you like what you hear, if you're a fan of the genre, please share this with your friends, like us on Facebook and Instagram, and on the podcast, click subscribe to hear upcoming episodes of Dan Marcus's Wax Museum. Thanks. Now, my full phone conversation with Carl Giamorisi of the Buckinghams, one of the Midwest's most successful bands. You'll hear how they had the number one song in America and no record contract. How'd that happen? They've also played two presidential inaugurations. And how did it happen that they had three songs in the top 20 at once? All that's ahead. Here's my conversation with Carl Giamorisi of the Buckinghams. Carl Giamorisi has been with the Buckinghams since the inception of the band and before they were even the Buckinghams. How are you, Carl?
I'm doing great, Dan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. I'm really privileged and pleased to talk to you because we've talked before and you've got interesting stories to tell. And thank you for bringing them here.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to speak to somebody from our neighbor state up in Wisconsin. I know before we started the podcast, we talked a little bit about the Bears-Green Bay rivalry, yeah. So we won't get into that.
No, because we got some Seattle Seahawks fans here. And they're listening all over. So, listen, the Buckinghams coming out of Chicago in the 60s, I mean, did you form as a garage band, bunch of high school guys getting together, or what happened?
Yeah, I mean, we were, you know, I guess you could use that term, garage band, even though we were more like basement bands, because what we would do is we would rehearse at our parents' house. We'd pick one of the guys' parents where they lived, their house, and we would rehearse in the basement until they got tired of all the noise and they'd kick us out and we'd move to the next guy's house. Yeah. You know, that's what was going on. But, you know, the music scene in the middle 60s in Chicago was so tremendous. There were so many venues, you know, dances and teen clubs. And so if you formed a band, if you were halfway decent, you were pretty much guaranteed you'd get a gig, you know, and play. And it was really taking off in the middle 60s.
So what kind of songs was it the Pulsations did you do?
Yeah, I mean, my first band was a group called the Centuries, and that was the first band I ever played in, and I was asked to join. I had a cousin, Jerry Ilardi. Jerry was a drummer and a great singer. He asked me to join him and a couple friends. We had a guy by the name of Kurt Bachman on the bass, and Nick Fortuna, who's with me now, original Buckingham, was in that band, you know. So we formed a band, and we were playing venues around, well, mostly they were in the suburbs just north of Chicago. And I have a picture of us performing out in front of an appliance store. And there we are playing in between washing machines and refrigerators. They're out there with us, you know. I mean, that was like one of our first gigs, you know. I think we were all playing through one amplifier, you know, and a drummer. And you know, so that was, you know, the beginning. And then that group broke up after a couple of years. And I joined the Pulsations.
Okay.
And Pulsations were John Polis, which was Buckingham's original drummer.
Right.
Dennis Tufano on vocals. And we had George LeGros, another singer in the group, who unfortunately got drafted and left the band right before, you know, we had just become the Buckinghams and had to leave.
Oh, boy.
And missed out on a great opportunity.
Yeah,
I'll tell you.
Bad timing.
But anyway, so we were the Pulsations for a short time, once.
You were trying to be the Beatles, doing Beatle music and...
Yeah, we were covering everything. I mean, we were a cover band, like everybody was back then. We were doing everything.
Yeah.
We were you know, playing James Brown. We were doing soul music, Sam and Dave, James Brown. We were doing Beatles songs, you know, you name it. You know, whatever pop, you know, top 40, whatever was on the charts at the time, you know, we would perform those songs.
Was it a love of music? Why'd you get into it? Was it a love of music? Did you like singing? Were you trying to meet the girls? What was it?
Well, kind of a little bit of both, of everything there.
That's fair.
You know, when I started playing guitar when I was... 13-year-old kid. You know, I lived in kind of a rough neighborhood in Chicago called Uptown. And, you know, I was being exposed to not a lot of good things. You know, it was easy to get in trouble. And I think my parents were looking for a diversion, you know, something for me to get into.
Was guitar your first instrument?
Yeah.
What was your first guitar? Brand name and model, do you remember?
And I still have it here.
Do you?
You know, it was a Harmony. harmony guitar.
Sure.
You know, a flat top, you know, with the hole in the middle.
Yep.
It was
acoustic.
It was an acoustic guitar. Yep. It was about, you know, maybe 3 inches thick.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was sort of like scaled down. It wasn't a full size guitar even.
Okay.
The neck was, the frets were a little shorter.
Kind of like a Rickenbacker is, right?
It's even smaller than that.
Really?
I mean, wow. There are guitars, professionally guitars, that are scaled down, you know, for okay. various reasons. But
yeah.
this was just a plain old small guitar that okay. didn't play very well. But it didn't matter at the time because I didn't play guitar very well either. I was just starting out.
Yep.
And I still remember, you know, I'm left-handed, and my dad signed me up for some guitar lessons. They said to the teacher, you know, he's left-handed. And she says, I don't care. He's going to learn how to play right-handed.
Really?
And wow. You know what? That was the best thing she ever did, because it really didn't matter at that point. You know, at that point, I mean, I couldn't play left-handed or right-handed, but it made life a lot easier because, you know, to always have to look for a left-handed guitar and learn everything backwards, you know, it would have been more difficult.
Interesting.
I give Paul McCartney a lot of credit. He does it.
I don't know how a left-handed...
I would have to say he does it very well.
So. I don't know how a left-handed musician can play a piano. I don't understand that.
Yeah, I don't know that...
Because there are no left-handed pianos, are there?
No, not really.
I didn't think so.
You know, you might have a little more strength in your left hand if you're left-handed. It's hard to say. I'm not really a piano player. I know piano, and I certainly know piano theory, and can make chords and play a little bit, but I wouldn't consider myself a piano player. But anyway, so that started it out. I started playing guitar when I was 13, and then, you know, moved up to a little better guitar. I remember I had an L5 Gibson guitar. It was
nice.
An arch top full size guitar.
Nice.
And, you know, my first thoughts was I was thinking, well, I could play in a big band, maybe be a guitar player in a big band.
Okay.
I always wanted to be a guitar player more than a singer, you know, at that point. You know, and then worked my way up, and then I finally, you know, my first electric guitar was an SG, a Gibson SG. Like a Les Paul, you know, with the double cutaway.
Sure, yeah.
It was kind of an off-white color. I was really excited about that. And so I had that for a while. And then Nick Fortuna and I bought a couple Fender Stratocasters.
I have. And to me, that's the ultimate rock and roll guitar right there. That's got the look. It's got
the
sound.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a great guitar all the way around. It's so easy to, you know, I don't even carry a guitar with me anymore. Because, you know, when I took over singing lead in the Buckinghams way back in 81 or whatever
it
was.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
You know, I don't play because we have a guitar player, Dave Zane, and I play on maybe 5 or 6 songs in the show.
Sure.
So they supply me with a Fender, you know, our contract writer states what kind of guitar I want, which is a Fender Stratocaster with certain gauge strings on it and set up a certain way.
Interesting.
And you know what? 9 out of 10 times, it's perfect. It's just what I need.
Good.
And then I don't have to carry it. Play what they bring in, and it works just fine.
So here are the Pulsations, and they win the WGN radio contest, and all of a sudden you've got a recording contract. Were you intimidated, excited, what?
Yeah, we were real excited. I mean, you know, we auditioned for the all-time hits show on WGN along with many bands around Chicago. And
was it WGN TV or radio? I forget.
TV,
WGN
TV.
Okay.
And, you know, at the time, which is still the case, I mean, it's a syndicated TV station, so you can pick it up in markets all over the country.
Right.
And so we were getting, you know, major exposure. I remember years later, they interviewed the producer of the show. Somehow they got on the subject of how they picked the Buckinghams for that show. And he made a comment. He says, well, they were the least worst.
Really? Wow. Are you kidding me?
He might have been joking, but you know, I don't think he wasn't a rock and roll buff or even, you know.
Man, that's winning by default, man.
He could have said we were the best, you know. That's why we won, you know.
Oh, but, wow.
You know, I don't know if he was joking around with that or what.
Yeah, but by that time, by the time that comment got back to you, you had sold about a zillion records, so...
Right. And we were new. I mean, hey, we weren't playing that long when we, you know, I was like probably a 17-year-old kid and, you know, had planned that long. And, you know, doing that TV show, you know, they didn't figure out yet how to get the sound to work on television. And they kept telling us to turn down. How do you turn down in a rock band? I mean, you know, to the point the drummer was hardly, John was hardly hitting the drums.
Really?
You know, they didn't want us. And you know, he kept turning my amplifier down. And so you couldn't get anything behind it, you know.
No, sure. Just, no, right. I get that completely.
But it was, you know, a 13-week show, you know, and they changed our name from the Pulsations to the Buckinghams.
Because?
Well, they didn't like the name, and I could understand that. And they wanted to capitalize on the British invasion. Sure. And we became friends with a security guard that worked for the show. John O'Pager, his name was. Unfortunately, John passed away several years ago. But he was a great guy. And he threw the name out at us. Hey, how about the Buckinghams? And we thought about it a minute. We couldn't believe there was no other band called that, especially from across the pond. And we said, oh, that sounds good. Let's do that.
You know? Not knowing any better, when I first heard your name, when I first heard of the Buckinghams, and knowing you were from Chicago, I thought you were named after the fountain.
Well, it you know, that's a story in itself. I mean, you know, a lot of people thought that, you know, and a lot of people thought we were a British group because we also had that Carnaby look.
Well, you did that on purpose, though, for the sake of the image,
of course.
I guess.
I mean, that was the look we were trying to get across. And, you know, I've told this story many times on stage and probably in another interview. But, you know, when we got out to L.A. to do the Smothers Brothers show and we walked out on stage, on the sound stage to do a run-through, they had the whole stage decorated with British flags and the Union Jack. Mm. They thought we were a British group.
They thought.
They didn't even know.
Oh, wow.
And we did the show. I mean, if you ever go on YouTube and check it out, when we did the Smothers Brothers, I think it was June of 67, you see in the background, you see all the British flags hanging and the Union Jack.
And did you do kind of a drag? Was that the song you did on Smothers Brothers?
I think we did Mercy, Mercy, Mercy.
Okay.
You might have did Don't You Care also.
Well, your first hit was kind of a drag nationally, and that went to number one. And I'm thinking, these 17 and 18-year-old kids are thinking, this music thing is pretty easy.
Well, you know.
I mean, your first hit goes to number one nationwide, your first release.
Yeah, it did come pretty fast for us. I will admit that it did seem easy. I mean, the hard part came after we were successful because trying to keep up with it. And I mean, my God, we played, you know, probably over 300 dates in 67.
Wow.
You know, we were traveling, and these are one-nighters. So we were playing and then going back to New York to record a new song and then going back on the road again. And it wasn't easy. I mean, it was hard. And we were young, so we could deal with it.
You mentioned 1967, though. Forgive me for interrupting, but before we get too far away from that, Billboard magazine said that you were the most listened to band of 1967. Wow.
Well, yeah, we appreciate that. That was great. And I'm sure they were right because, I mean, seriously, who had more top 10, you know, unless you're the Beatles, I guess. But 67, you know, we had, you know, five records that were in the top 10 on the charts.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And even in the top five, you know, Mercy, Mercy, Mercy hit five and Kind of a Drag, of course, was number one.
Can we run down a list of some of those songs and give me that brief paragraph on how it came to you or who wrote it? And let's start with Kind of a Drag. How'd you get your hands on that one?
Well, Kind of a Drag, you know, we were looking for an original song. The band was not writing songs at the time. Like I said earlier, we were a cover band. We were just doing whatever was on the top of the charts at the time. And so we were looking for something, and we had a couple hits that were bubbling under hits, you know, and then they were hits in Chicago. We covered I'll Go Crazy, James Brown's song, The Beatles, I Call Your Name. So they were cover tunes, but we wanted an original song. So our manager, Carl Bonifetti, he was looking for a song for us, and he tapped on a songwriter in Chicago. His name was Jim Holday, and Jim played with a big horn band called The Mob, and they were a show band. They would play Vegas, you know. So he was writing songs that weren't really right for them. So Carl went over to his, I think it was his hotel room, with the reel-to-reel tape player, if there's any young people out there listening, they're probably scratching their heads going, what the heck is
real? What's real, real? Yeah.
It's a big tape player, you know, and he goes there with a microphone and the tape player, and he records Jim Hovey strumming on his guitar and singing kind of a drag, totally different than we recorded it. So he brought us back that song, and we listened to it, and we thought it was kind of catchy. We liked the way it opened up, and just the kind of a drag is such a term that is used so much even today. You know?
Yeah,
man,
sure.
It's kind of a drag. Yeah, we thought it was just really a cool song. So we rehearsed it. We were at the time rehearsing it at my parents' house where I lived in my basement. I remember my mother even commenting. She says, well, that's a catchy song. You know, that could be a hit record for you guys, you know, while we were putting it together. And so we went into the studio at Chess Studios in Chicago, the famous, world-famous blues studio.
Very famous studio, yeah.
Yeah, all the blues artists were recording there. And we didn't know much about it at the time. You know, I realized later in life what that studio was all about.
Right.
We were just a bunch of rock and rollers who wanted to make records. So we had a producer, Dan Belloc, who had the idea of adding horns, because we weren't a horn band either. You know, we were a five-piece rock band. And he says, well, we could really dress this up with horns. And Dan was also the leader of a big band, more old-time band. So he enlisted his horn players from that band to come into the session. And the guy who wrote the charts for the song was his trombone player, Frank Tyczynski.
Okay.
Frank was a trombone. So he wrote the charts. And if you notice, it's our horn sound. The voicing is kind of trombone heavy.
Yes.
You know, which makes sense because he's a trombone player, so he wrote it. And, you know, not to get ahead of myself, I'll just throw this little sidebar in. Our next producer manager also produced the group Chicago, and that sound continued on in Chicago. If you listen to their sound, the trombone, so I'm just throwing that out there.
No, that's valid. That's a valid point.
So we recorded the song with the horns, and we were kind of excited. You know, we thought it'd be great. And, you know, and our record label at the time, USA Records, based out of Chicago, kind of waited to release it. They didn't release it right away, which we didn't know why, but they didn't. But finally they did, and it just took off overnight. I mean, it's just all these different markets started picking it up.
And I'm thinking there was not a lot of record company promotion behind the song. I think the song itself, the record itself, sold itself without a whole bunch of, here are the Buckinghams, and here come the Buckinghams, and all that kind of splash that you get with new bands, or did back then. I think it was the song. I think it was totally the song.
Well, it was. You know, I've had many, many program directors through the years that were from back in the day come up to me. We're playing somewhere now. You know, when we got that record in, you know, they used to get, I don't know, 100, 200 records a week.
Sure, yeah.
To listen
That's
to.
True.
And they'd throw it on and listen to the first, if they didn't like it in the first 10 seconds, they'd throw it. Corner, you know, listen to the next one or whatever. And the minute they heard the intro, it just grabbed them right away. And then the first line, kind of a drag, just grabbed them right away.
Yeah.
And he said, that did it for them. You know,
I remember when the song first came out, being impressed with, this is a brand new sound. Listen to those horns on a rock and roll song. It definitely stood out.
Well, we were using, you know, not only the horn sound, but we were doing some things that nobody was doing much of up to that point. I mean, there were other people who used horns, but we were using chord changes that were a little different. We were using augmented and diminished chords in our songs, which kind of wasn't heard of in rock music at the time.
Pretty advanced stuff.
Yeah. I mean, of course, the Beatles touched on it, and, you know, they were so innovative with their time changes and different stuff they were doing. But it wasn't done a lot, you know, where you could incorporate these type of chords into the songs and the voices, you know, and so forth.
When Kind of a Drag hit number one, do you remember the song you knocked out of the top spot?
Yes, I do.
It was?
It was The Monkees. I'm a Believer.
I'm a Believer. Yeah.
Yeah. That knocked the Monkees right off the number one spot.
And that had been that was number one for 7 weeks. Bravo. Wow.
Well, we played many shows with the late Davy Jones. Sorry to say he's gone. But I used to kid him about that, you know.
Did you?
Same thing with Mickey Dolenz. I mean, Mickey's been on, he did the Happy Together tour with us.
And, sure.
You know, and other dates. And we've talked about that. But it's like, he just looked at me like, yeah, well, so what? So what do you want me to say? You know, who cares? I'm a monkey, you know? I had a lot of hits.
Sure. You followed up kind of a drag with Laudy Miss Claudy. Different sound on that, a little bit. A little different style.
Yeah, well, you know, we didn't know much about the original hit, of course, of Laudy was Lloyd Price.
Lloyd Price, yeah.
Back in the day, I mean, it was like, what did that, when was that, 1960 maybe? Or
well, no, I looked it up. He 62. Did Laudy Miss Claudy. You did it in 67. He did it in 52, 15 years
52,
earlier.
52, yeah. So that was, it's funny, we talk about that now. I just did that song again. I've been producing a friend of mine. He's an older gentleman who always wanted to write songs. He's doing a few cover tunes too. And so I'm producing some songs and he wanted to do Laudy Miss Claudy. So what I did was I listened to Lloyd Price and I copied his version along with a little bit of Eric Clapton type guitar stuff. And it was, you know, that trill at the beginning and the piano.
Right.
Put that in there, you know, and did it a lot more like the original version. Of course, it's been covered by Elvis and many other artists. But at the time when we did it for our first album, the Kind of a Drag album. It was one of the cover songs we did on stage. And at the time, the Buckinghams were big fans of the group The Hollies.
Sure.
And we just love The Hollies.
Yeah, sure.
Their songs. I mean, our drummer, Bus Stop. Campbell, loved them. He tried to copy Bobby Elliott's drum licks. You know, he was like so into him. So they did a version of it, real fast, up-tempo, kind of like we did it, but without horns, you know.
Right.
And we did it because they did it, and we didn't even know much about Lloyd Price or anything. It was just, to us, it was just, hey, the Hollies did that song. We like it. Let's do it.
Okay.
So we recorded it, then they put horns on that. And then what happened was our record deal, after Kind of a Drag came out, and it was number one, our record deal ran out.
Fell apart,
USA. And, I mean, it was really good for us.
Good timing.
Good timing. I mean, can you imagine having the number one record in the country and not having a record deal? And it's like,
how many labels were after you guys with a number one song?
Man, a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, we did wind up with Columbia, and our new producer manager Jim Guercio.
Right.
The direction we went, and of course we went to New York. I remember we signed contracts with Columbia on our way to New York to record "Don't You Care." And USA, they wanted to follow up, obviously, with something after Kind of a Drag. So that was the only song they really had in the can that made any sense.
Was Laudy Miss Claudy?
So it was Laudy Miss Claudy. So they released Laudy Miss Claudy, and of course Columbia released "Don't You Care." And, you know, we wound up with three hits on the charts at the same time.
Wow.
You know, Kind of a Drag was just coming down from number one. I think Don't You Care was maybe about number seven at that point.
Yeah.
And Laudy was 15 or 16 or whatever.
Interesting.
And so because of that, we wound up with three hits on the charts.
Part of the reason why Billboard said you were the most listened to band of 1967. Don't You Care, really cool sound and continuing the Kind of a Drag trumpet sound. And then along comes Mercy, Mercy, Mercy. And that's got some funk to it there, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, you know, there was some funk in our group. You know, our late keyboard player, Marty Gribb, was a pretty funky guy. You know, he's such a great player. And of course, you know, we grew up on playing soul tunes too. And as probably everybody knows, that song was a hit by Cannonball Adderley back in 67.
Okay.
It was a jazz instrumental.
I did not know that. So, okay. Good.
Yeah, so Cannonball Adderley, great jazz guy, his keyboard player, Zollinal, his name was, he wrote it. So then there was a couple guys that were real soul dudes, Johnny Guitar Watson, Williams and Watson recorded it, and they funked it up and wrote the words to it.
Oh,
and
okay.
They did a recording of it and released it, and it was a minor hit, you know, on the soul charts. It was great. So we didn't even know about it. And when we were doing our first Columbia album, looking for material, our manager, producer, Jim Guercio, brought the song to us because he played with Johnny Guitar Watson back in the day, and he knew what they were doing, and he knew them. So he brought us the song, and all we did was we copied it. We did it pretty much the same way they did it. Theirs was a little, well, you could imagine, they were soul guys, you know. Two very soulful. But we got pretty close. You know, there's a little bit of pop in there too, but I think we got pretty close with the feel, you know.
You know, in 1967, I'm wondering, was the song banned by any stations because they objected to the reference to Playboy bunnies in the lyrics?
No.
Okay, good.
Never heard any negativity.
Because things were so buttoned down compared to the way they are now that I could see that happening. But no, good. I'm glad to hear that.
Just, yeah, I mean, it is a little, I don't know, you know, maybe for the time. My baby, she's made out of love, like one of those bunnies out of a Playboy club. I mean, that's, I guess, I don't know.
That's a stretch, and that's just me.
So, you know, so that was that. So we recorded it, and we thought it was just going to be one of the cuts on the album. But when the A&R people at Columbia heard it, this is after Don't You Care was a hit, they said, this has got to be the next single.
And it worked.
Yeah, and we were so glad because it took us away from it, brought us out of where we were, you know, kind of a drag, Don't You Care.
You had a pigeonhole sound.
Yeah. And this was different. And it's one of my, you know, I don't know, you know, probably my favorite Buckingham song is Don't You Care, but Mercy is definitely my favorite as far as playing live. You know, I enjoy doing that song.
It's a great song, and I can see why you'd enjoy doing it. The Hey Baby, they're playing our song, always felt like that was just a rehearsal session that accidentally got recorded. You know, there's just a spontaneity to it.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, Hey Baby, of course, we recorded all our songs at Columbia Studios in New York City, except for Kind of a Drag.
Okay.
And so, you know, we came into New York to record. We did the basic tracks for Hey Baby and Susan at the same time.
Okay.
We were in New York, and you know, we would do the tracks. We would put down a basic track with drums, bass, guitar, piano. We would do the vocals, and then our producer would leave it up to him to do the sweetening, which was any horns and strings, with maybe a little bit of input from us, because we'd go back out and start playing again.
Right, because you were a hot property, and time in the studio was time wasted selling concert tickets. Right?
Yeah, well, that was, you know, what it was all about. It, you know, and it still is today.
Yep.
It's live performing. Believe me, I tried to figure out how you make royalties from streaming, and it is a nightmare.
Is it?
And there's not much money there either in streaming and compared to the record deals. And
I suppose.
And so forth. But before we go on, you know, as long as we're at this point, I start thinking about artists and what's going on today. Can I throw something in here that's kind of takes us off?
No, that's good. Yeah, what's on your mind?
Here? Well, I'm thinking, you know, there's a Save Our Stage Act. It's legislation that was just passed in Congress by both Republican and Democrats. Save Our Stage Act. And it's sort of put together by an organization called NEVA. It's a collaboration of patrons and businesses and organizations to fund independent venues and promoters. And what's happening is, and it's scary right now because we don't know what's going to happen.
With the pandemic situation,
the pandemic is over, and will music come back? Will the venues, because the venues are suffering now. And this is...
As a point of reference, let me throw in that we're recording this early January of 2021 after nearly a year of concerts being just shut down and there's no touring or anything. So go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt,
right,
Carl. But
no, that's okay. But I'm very supportive of this. And, you know, people could donate if they want to. You know, the address is NIVASSOC.org. And you could donate. And the whole idea is to help these independent venues and promoters and people that put on the shows and concerts and clubs and theaters.
Because places are closing and bands are breaking up. And
it's not good. It's a terrible situation for entertainers, you know, and I don't mean to slam what's going, you know, when you see the news now, you see a lot on, whether you watch CNN or Fox or whatever news network or local news about how the restaurants are suffering and people are unemployed that work there and restaurants are closing. And believe me, I don't take anything away from that. I feel for those people. And
yes.
It's tough what's going on. But there's not much talk about what musicians are going through and the entertainers, you know. Yeah. And we're a special breed of people, musicians, entertainers. It's a different breed, you know. We're creative and sensitive people. We're, mostly self-employed. We don't have employers to help us in a lot of ways. And there are so many. I mean, I'm not one of them that's suffering that bad. You know, I mean, I'm fine. But, you know, I have a lot of friends who are, you know, it's just brutal for musicians now. Their tours are canceled, clubs closed, you know, record deals. deals are gone. You know, the windows are closing for those artists that had, say, they just got a record deal and everything kind of went south now.
Well, here's hoping that when the time is right, that people come back to the concerts and overcompensate for the live music that they've been missing, because...
I hope so.
Yeah, they will. I guarantee so. You, Carl, they will.
I mean, there's, you know, a major uptick in drug use now, and it's a helpless feeling. And I got to thinking about it because here in Chicago, in the Chicago Tribune, there's an article in the arts and entertainment section about this. And I started reading it this morning, and, you know, if anybody wants to Google that Chicago Tribune article, too, it just kind of says it all.
Drives it home.
But anyway, that's all I want to say about that. And it's and the relief fund is emergency relief fund. You can donate, like I said.
Is any of this information on your website?
I'm going to put it up there.
Okay. What's your website while we're on that subject? Website, Facebook page, any social media?
TheBuckinghams.com is our website. We'll do it. I'll put it up on Facebook. So just go to the Buckinghams Facebook page.
Okay.
The homepage, and I'll put something up there about it, get that together.
Because I'll
probably put it on my own page too, the Carl G. Maurice Facebook page.
Okay. I know that one tour that I was really looking forward to in the summer of 2020 was canceled, and that was the Cornerstones of Rock.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit earlier about my good friend Jim Peterick, and I know you've had him on your show, and I love Jim because
he's great.
I applaud his enthusiasm, his creativity, his major talent.
For those who might not recognize the name, Jim Peterick, founding member of the Ides of March, who did the song Vehicle, and former member of Survivor, and also from Chicago, just like you, Carl.
Right, and one of the two writers that wrote the song Eye of the Tiger.
Yes.
He's an inspiration because that guy's always going. He's got so much
energy.
He kind of pushes everybody else to keep it going, you know.
So are you going to be able to revive the Cornerstones of Rock tour? Because it was Buckingham's, it was the Ides of March, it was
Crying Shames
out of Chicago.
New Colony 6.
Out of Chicago,
But the main part of that show now is the Buckingham's, the Ides, Crying Shames, and New Colony 6, and Jimmy Sands from The Shadows of Night.
Oh, wow,
That's basically the show now.
That's pure Chicago, right? Right there.
You know, we did that was a PBS special years ago.
Oh, was it?
Maybe about 6 years ago, was it?
Okay.
It did very well on PBS. It played in a lot of different markets around the country.
I want to see that.
Very well in Chicago. We turned it into a live show, and it's been very successful. There's one particular venue in Chicago area in St. Charles called the Arcata Theater. Ron Onesti's Arcata Theater, and he's brought us in there 2 or 3 times a year, and it's always sold out.
Wow.
We've done several others, many with the show, and right now it's on hold. I mean, it's been postponed about 3 times already. It will
come back, right?
Yeah. Once we're past this pandemic, we'll start playing, doing that show again.
I want to get back to your set list with Susan. That song fascinates me because I actually sort of like the noise in the middle of that song.
Well,
but I know you don't.
I think it was you and 3 other people that really liked it.
Yeah. In particular, I liked the way, because that's the middle 8, if you will, okay, for lack of a better term. But I love the way you come out of it with the harmonized love, 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 love. That's a hook for me. I like that.
Well, I've told this story many times, but what I like about it now is it gives me something to talk about regarding the song. It's because people ask me that all the time. You know, what happened was I mentioned earlier how we recorded the tracks in New York for Hey Baby and Susan at the same time. And then when we left, we recorded that song like the others where we did we put our parts on there and everything and left it up to our producer to sweeten it, mix it, and get it done. But there were so many bars of empty space, kind of we call it a click track in there that was just from A to B was just empty in there. And we kept saying, well, Jimmy, what are you doing? Going, oh, he says, don't worry about it. I got an idea. I'm going to do something. You know, you'll hear it. Okay, whatever. You know what I mean? He's a great producer, did a great job.
Hadn't done you wrong so far. So, jump on that, right? Trust me.
Yeah. So we went back out on the road and traveling, and we were upstate New York. But anyway, you know, back in those days before digital.
Before the internet, yeah.
The internet and MP3s and whatever. He just sent us over an acetate to listen to.
What'd you think?
Test pressing. So, well, we put it on a record player. We thought it sounded great. We loved what he put in there. And then all of a sudden it got to that spot. All of a sudden there's this, all this, you know, yeah. What the hell is going on here? We thought, you know, there might have been something that the test pressing was damaged or something.
You thought it was a mistake. Yeah.
Yeah, we put it on again. It did the same thing. And then it comes out with the love, love, love. And we realized, well, that's what he had in mind. And we thought it was kind of weird. We didn't like it up front. But
and it hasn't grown on you at all, has it?
Not so much, yeah. No. And, you know, a lot of stations back then edited that part out.
Yeah.
You know, they would go right from the bridge right into Girl, I Love You, right into Love, Love, Love.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
And because it works that way, too. And that's kind of how we do it on stage.
Sure.
You know,
but, yeah, that, it's a good song. It's just different than any other Buckingham song for that reason alone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely is.
I find it interesting that you ended up becoming a commercial singer.
Well, yeah. I mean,
what are some of the jingles you sang that we would recognize?
Oh, my God. I sang between 1976 and 1982. I probably sang on about 300 some odd commercials.
Wow. You deserve a break today kind of things, right?
Yeah. Well, I did several different McDonald's. There was one called the McDonald's Champ, where it was something thick Cokes, icy shakes, thick Cokes, Sundays, and apple pies, and then the jingle da 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 da, and then at the end,
okay.
You deserve a break today at McDonald's.
That had to be fun, different, challenging.
Yeah, I mean, I did RC Cola, some beer commercials.
Fun.
I don't know if you remember when United Airlines used to do all the commercials, and then there was a tag at the end of the commercial that went, "Fly the friendly skies."
Yep, that was you.
That was me in a group with other people. And it was very lucrative because that was either SAG or AFTRA. And every time they'd go in the studio to do a new commercial jingle, and then they would take that tag at the end and put it on there, they'd have to pay you again. So, you were making money. I remember the first commercial I ever sang on, it was for Lava Soap, which isn't even in existence.
Wow.
Anymore.
Wow. I remember Lava Soap.
Yeah.
Pumice. And, it had pumice.
Yeah. Well, it had pumice in it, I'll tell you. There were three of us singing on that, and everybody was excited to do it. And I remember the session was, I got paid about $300 for session, not thinking about the residuals that you'd be making every 13 weeks.
Yeah.
And so that thing ran for about 3 years, and I probably made about, $10,000 a year.
Wow. Wow.
From that one little spot. You
buy a house with pumice soap jingles. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what happened, when the Buckinghams broke up in 1970, the original band, me and Dennis Tufano went on to form a duo called Tufano and Jim. Well, first we were Dennis and Carl. And then our producer wanted to use our last names, which was a mouthful, Tufano and Gia Morisi.
Yeah, yeah.
So we did three albums with the great Lou Adler. He was the producer.
He fascinates me.
Yeah, he produced, at the time, he had just come off of 7 Grammy Awards with Carole King's album, Tapestry.
Oh,
wow. Of course, he produced the Mamas and Papas. And, he was out in L.A., and he was a great guy and a great producer and very talented. And he signed us, and based on a song that I wrote called Music Everywhere, was our first single. You know, we had a little bit of success with it, but nothing great. And over the course of about 5 years or so, we did three albums with him, and we just never had the success we had with the Buckinghams. It was a great experience because I got to work with a lot of great musicians in the studio out in L.A.
Did you have any experience with the Wrecking Crew?
Yeah, some of those guys played on our records. Hal Blaine, drummer.
Because they were, at that time, they were one of music's best kept secrets. People didn't talk about the Wrecking Crew, and now all of a sudden, because of the documentary, and it's a fascinating documentary, they're famous. They're a band.
Yeah, they were great, great players, Me and Dennis, you had some great, people wouldn't know these guys. There was Tom Scott, sax player, producer, jazz guy, his band called the LA Express, they backed us up on a lot of our recording.
Okay.
It was Tufano and Jerry studio guys, you know. And at the time, Tom was also doing the music for two TV shows, Starsky and Hutch, mm-hmm. and Beretta. Because he produced the last Tufano and Jim Morrissey album. But anyway, by the time it got to be about 1976, Dennis and I decided to break up. Things weren't going that great for us. And I came back. I was in Chicago, and I was like, kind of like, well, what do I do now?
You know? Yeah. Everybody has those moments.
Yeah, it was just like, now what? You know, my career at Buckingham's, that's over with. And then I had a dear friend, Bonnie Herman, and her husband at the time, Tom Radke, a drummer, the sessions in Chicago. He's a great session drummer. But Bonnie was the premier singer for Jingles. I mean, she's just a remarkable voice and singer. And she also sang in a group called the High Lows and Singers Unlimited. And she was doing all the jingle, you know. So anyway, she introduced me to the jingle business. They helped me out.
Okay.
You know, she listened, helped me put a demo together, and then introduced me to some of the producers around Chicago. And that's what got me started. It worked out. So I did that until it kind of overlapped with, you know, the Buckinghams first got back together again in 1980 to play in Chicago at the Chicago Fest on Navy Pier. And we did it because I got a call from John Guerin, the program director at WLS Radio, asked us if we would do a reunion. And at first it was like, I don't know about this. But then I talked to Dennis Tufano and Nick Fortuna, and they agreed to do it. And Marty Grab at the time, our keyboard, he was playing with Chicago at the time, so he wasn't available. So we got a few other guys to play with us. We rehearsed a couple weeks, and we went up there and played, and 12,000 people showed up.
Wow.
And you sensed right then, 1980, that all of a sudden there was a resurgence in 60s music.
Yes, there was.
I mean, it was starting. And people say, why? Why is that? And I think what was happening was our audience was at that age where, you know, let's say in their 30s or early 30s even, and where they had expendable income, but they wanted to hear their music again.
And it wasn't
out.
Yeah, and it wasn't out there anymore.
Right. And they were still young, you know, young enough, and they wanted to hear those songs. And so you felt it. You just felt this magic, this happening again. And
that's exciting.
And then, you know, Dennis Tufano decided he just didn't want to go out and tour anymore. You know, he was in L.A. and he was pursuing an acting career and other things. And so then I took over, and Nick talked me into going on and doing this. And we got some other players, and we made a bunch of changes through the years with different personnel. By 85, we did the Happy Together tour that year, which was the number one tour in 85. Well, it was so long. It was a 7-month tour.
That was a heck of a lineup on that, especially that first year was, of course, the Turtles and the Buckinghams. And I remember Gary Lewis.
Yeah, Gary Lewis.
Grassroots, I think.
And the Grassroots, that's it.
Yeah.
You got it. Yeah, that was.
And Spanky McFarlane was with them, or was that the second year?
Was actually the first year in 84, because our tour was 85. So the first year they did Happy Together was 84.
And then you joined on.
84 was Gary Puckett, the Union Gap. It was Spanky and our gang.
Yeah.
It was the Association and the Turtles.
I hope to meet up with Spanky McFarlane again. We haven't spoken since that tour in 84, but holy smoke, she is just a ball of energy and a delight.
Definitely.
Tell me about playing the White House and the inauguration.
Well, we had two opportunities. It was great both times. You know, we played for George Bush's second inauguration, and we played for Obama's first.
Wow.
And that came about because a dear friend of ours, Terry Duffy, he's the chairman of the board of the Mercantile Exchange and the Board of Trade. The agricultural, you know, he was involved in that. So we played for the agricultural ball. How that works is in during the inauguration, there's several balls that go on.
Yes, at the same time, concurrently.
At the same time, and the president tries to make the rounds, you know. And I remember the we were excited the first time, even being in D.C. and playing for that. And I tell you, a really great experience was I got there the day before, and Terry Duffy and his wife took my wife and I out to dinner that night. And so we didn't know what was happening. And so we get to this great restaurant, and we are escorted into a private room. And here's all these congressmen, senators, and their wives. And when we walked in, they all started singing Susan.
Really?
I was blown away. You know, it was just... it was just a great experience.
Wow, yeah.
To have these people in this caliber do that. And Terry Duffy would throw fundraisers at his house. And, you know, I'm kind of apolitical. I mean, I don't want to get into politics here, but I've had friends that are both Democrats and Republicans. And, you know, John Boehner was a friend.
Okay, sure.
So anyway, it was a great experience. We played that night at the ball, and things went great. And then when Obama, that was really an experience too, because, oh my God, to see that many people. I was at the inauguration to see a million people out there all at the same time.
Yeah.
The electricity involved. And, you know, I was felt so proud. You know, I loved his presidency too. I just liked the way he handled things. And he just seemed so down to earth. And real and caring.
And here you were playing his inauguration.
And here we were playing an inauguration. So both of them were very special in my life, you know, to have that opportunity. And I'm just so grateful it was given to us to be able to do that. It was a wonderful experience.
Sure was.
I always try to keep that perspective. And, you know, what sort of put it all into perspective, too, is, you know, what's happened with this pandemic, how we're all trapped at home and you're trying to social distance and wear masks, which we all better do and should do. And whether you're Lady Gaga or the guy down the street, you know, we're all doing the same thing. And, you know, it is what it is.
Well, Carl, we have reached that point in the program where I have 7 questions to ask you.
Oh, gosh.
And you know the premise here. I've got 7 questions. You have 60 seconds to answer all 7. No explanation necessary on your part. Okay?
Okay.
You ready?
I don't know if I'm ready.
This will be fun. Here we go.
All right.
Your least favorite high school class?
Math. Mr. Zelensky's class. I hated that. Algebra.
Car you learned to drive in?
A 56 Chevy.
Ooh. Favorite board game?
Chess.
Favorite movie?
Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, good. Favorite guilty pleasure?
Oh, I have so many guilty pleasures. I don't know. It's a guilty pleasure.
TikTok, Carl.
I want to pass on that.
Okay. Where did, then you have to answer this one. Where did your first boy-girl kiss take place?
In my apartment when I lived in Chicago. I was about 14 years old. And I still remember the girl's name was Pat. I'll just say that.
Okay. And finally, the song you wish would have been your hit.
Oh, man. There are so many songs that are just so great. God Only Knows.
Okay.
That came to my head first. There's a lot of them, but I'll throw that one out.
Those are all good choices and great answers. And thank you for bearing your soul on all those, Carl. I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. It's a pleasure. Dan, I hope we can meet up somewhere down the line here when we get back to playing.
Oh, we will. We definitely will. Yeah. Carl, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed talking with you and learning the history of the Buckinghams and everything that you're still up to. And it's just been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this much time.
I enjoyed it very much, Dan. Thank you. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure. Time flies when you're having fun.
Well, thank you. I agree. And continued good luck to you, your family.
Thank you.
Stay safe, and let's see you back on the road real soon.
Yeah, please be safe, stay well, do everything you're supposed to do, and let's get past this pandemic and all of us get out there in good health and have a great 2021.
Carl Giammarisi, thank you so much. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.